Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Well, howdy, y'all. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today's September 5th. I'm excited to be able to offer you today a little supplemental installment. It's actually not very little. It's pretty sizable. About an hour and a half. This is going to run you. Show with Kevin Geary and Daryl Becker. And I think the title is self-explanatory. Great conversation. I want to say thanks to Kevin Geary for inviting me on his Powerful Parenting podcast. Kevin Geary, of course, at this point, I would say frequent guest. I think he qualifies. Between August of 2014 and August of 2015, he was on the show three times. And you can search the School Sucks archives for Kevin Geary. If you have your own health and fitness puzzles you're trying to solve, actually, how about this? Wait to hear this suggestion. Go to rebootedbody.com and search there for answers to your specific questions. And Daryl, of course, voluntaryvisions.com, a super frequent contributor to the School Sucks Project, joins us in this conversation as well, and really appreciated a lot of his input on the subject. Kevin and Daryl, both parents. Brett, not a parent, that you should know up front. But I think this is a really great conversation to introduce people to the world of alternative education options outside of the government schooling system. So maybe you should pass it off to that friend or family member of yours who you're always trying to encourage to think differently or maybe be a little more open-minded about this subject. And if you are that friend or family member, welcome. This is called the School Sucks Podcast. Can you even believe it, that it would be called that? But hey, listen, before you shut this off, I'm going to explain that title in today's conversation. So just hang in there. Just give me a chance, will you? Now, there are some things that I wanted to cover in this discussion that we actually didn't get to. So I thought I would just do it in the opening monologue here. We talk a lot on this podcast about child-centered or child-directed education. It's a very desirable alternative to the public schooling system, which I do not really consider to be education. I will talk about that as well. But one thing that I was really hoping to focus on in this discussion was how to, as new parents or frustrated parents, how to start the process of exploring what the alternatives are. So there's a great resource for this. Her name is Lori A. Couture, and that is her website, loriacouture.com, C-O-U-T-U-R-E, Couture. And she is really one of the go-to people for attachment parenting or unschooling coaching. And I went to high school with her. She was a few years ahead of me. We were both in my freshman year newspaper publications class. Wow. So there's this question. How do parents start to take action on transitioning their kids? And if you already have kids who are going through the public schools and you find that's not the best place for them, a lot of people feel like they don't have any options because there's this false trichotomy between public school, paying a whole bunch of money to send your kids to a superior private school, or being one of those weird homeschool people. And we want to get away from that. We want to take the word schooling out of the equation, and we want to talk about what's the best way for your child to learn. How do you discover that? How do you foster that? How do you nurture that? So how do you get started? Lori's advice was, first of all, you have to free yourself as a parent, as a public school graduate yourself, because you probably have a lot of these preconceived notions about schooling and education that need to be addressed. So I would add to Lori's suggestions some of my own questions that you might want to ask yourself. First, what are your attitudes and beliefs? Do you feel like there is a clear division between learning and play, especially if you have a very young child? Do you feel like there is a clear division between learning and fun, School certainly seems to make one. But as Laurie has said, true learning looks nothing like schooling. Some other questions I think you might want to ask yourself. What do you believe your kids need to know? Do you worry about things like, will they fall behind the other kids? And if you did decide you wanted to go down a home education, real world education, I like that phrase even better. We'll talk about that in the show today. Child-directed learning experience outside of the public schools. How prepared are you for the unpredictable? Because, I mean, if you think about it, imagine the materials you're going to need. Now, if you just send your kids to the public school, it's easy. Say you've got Steve, your son, or Stevie. You call him Stevie because he's 11. Soon he's going to come to you and say, look, Mom, Dad, it's Steven. But for now, it's Stevie, and you send Stevie to the local public school, and you don't have to worry about materials. The school provides them. Stevie is 11, so he's in sixth grade. Great. Here's sixth grade crap math, third edition. Here's sixth grade crap social studies. Oh, look here on the front cover. This book is so old, your friend Rhonda had it in 1987. Whatever happened to Rhonda? Rhonda. Right? So that's the public school experience. Home education, nothing like that. And I think a parent really has to ready him or herself for many excursions to ensure that the right tools are available to your child. Art supplies, Legos, action figures, science and history books, picture books. How about cookbooks, puzzles, musical instruments, science project kits, a microscope, telescopes and other kinds of scopes, board games, building materials, sporting equipment, sewing supplies, etc. And another question, as you start to get more serious about alternatives to your child learning, air quotes, in a school, one thing that I would ask myself is, where do I live and what's going on here? What's available for my child to get involved in around these parts? And what other considerations are there? Okay, so what happens during the day? Obviously, the optimal situation is a two-parent family where one of the parents can stay home. Most people give up on the idea of educational alternatives outside of a school because it just doesn't work. Both parents have to work. And I've actually talked to people who involved childcare, not to be confused with daycare, of course, but actually needing people to, you know, come into the home while mom has to work if it's a single parent, or dad has to work if it's a single parent situation, or if both parents have to work, because today that is very much a reality. I actually did this with a boy in Bow, New Hampshire, where both parents worked and I would come in and basically facilitate the unschooling experience. We called it unschooling at the time. And I kept records of what we did. We made a portfolio, and I'm getting to that because that's a fun thing, to have a portfolio of what you do over the course of a year. But that might have to be an option. And dare I say, you know, if your child has special needs you don't feel the school is able to accommodate, it might be worth talking to somebody at the school about, you know, getting some support with one of these alternatives. That's how these people that I worked with back in 2010, 2011 were able to pull that off. Depending on where you live, you're also going to have to do a fair amount of research on whatever your state's homeschool laws are, and they vary widely from state to state, so much so that I've never even really bothered to talk about it on School Sucks. In most cases, you're going to be required to send something like a letter of intent to basically outline a plan with the superintendent. Now, some states will actually require you to provide your own curriculum, while other states don't. And that's another question that goes back to, where do I live and what's going on here? Do I live in a state that is friendly to out-of-school educational alternatives? Or out-of-school education? Because using the word alternative makes it sound like what's going on in school is automatically education, and it automatically ain't, let me tell you. Now, some states might require that certain academic subjects are included in this curriculum that you provide. Some states that will not be the case. I know this isn't really specific information, but these are just considerations. But very, very rarely is there going to be any compulsory directions to follow for how those topics or subjects should be pursued in the out-of-school educational environment. Another consideration, this goes to, again, to surroundings, it would be really wise to take a look at what kind of homeschool or unschool groups or programs or events are happening nearby. Because when you're pursuing a path that is so against the grain, I think networking with other families, other people who understand your situation, your goals, your philosophy, even if theirs might differ a little bit. I found there's a lot of tolerance in these communities for slightly different approaches. It's really, really good to have support from folks with similar goals and a similar philosophy. So find out what's going on around you, who's trying to do similar things, or who has, at the very least, similar attitudes about problems with the public schools. There is no better bonding experience in humanity than getting together with somebody to mutually take a crap on something you both don't like. And that's a fact. Now, my favorite part of this whole experience was keeping logs, taking photos, and creating documentation of what happened each day, or at the very least, each week when pursuing learning outside of the schools. And all of these records can be used to produce an end-of-the-year portfolio. Now, some states actually require a portfolio like this by law, but it's just a very cool thing to be able to put together. I got to do it once. So you're talking about like work samples, photos. Photos are the best. Interactions with other people in the community, which can also be documented by photos or letters. Any projects or artwork that can either be slipped into the portfolio or photographed, and the photographs can be put into the portfolio. Brochures of the places that you go, events that you attend. Cool one that I saw in one of Lori's videos was business cards of adults that your child meets. How cool. So then, at the end of doing something like this for a year, especially if you've had a child who spent some time in public school, contrast it to one of their past report cards, where your child's last 2 or 3 months are summed up by a near stranger with letters and numbers. Two different types of reflective experiences, right? One, a beautiful keepsake that can last forever. The other one that looks like some kind of coded Stasi record keeping, just letters and numbers aside from a few cryptic notes in the margin. Likes doing things with colors, plays well with others. Okay, I realize that bringing East Germany into this is overdoing it. I live in the real world. I know when I go too far. But again, two very different types of record keeping. That is the point I would like to stress. Or you can invite that nosy, judgmental neighbor over who's always trying to quiz your unschooled child on the state capitals and say, you know what? I want you to see Stevie's portfolio, but, you know, bring Gregory's report card and we'll have a look at that too. Burn. I kid sometimes on the show, and really this is about having a meaningful record of your own child's learning. It's not for showing up the neighbors. Honestly, I don't recommend engaging in things like that, even though we do talk about it a little bit in the conversation you're going to hear today. But let's go back to the beginning. Because especially if you're taking a child out of the public schools, there is going to be a transition. And I think that in the beginning, your child having the freedom to follow their own interests is really important. And not to stress yourself out about what they should be doing or that question, that worry that you might have had, are they falling behind? Focus on, you know, them having fun, you having fun with them, and really building a stronger parent-child connection. But there is going to be this detox period, and my suggestion would be that probably shouldn't take place in front of a TV. I mean, if you're taking a kid out of school, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, that's probably what they're going to want to do. But what I would encourage is getting outside of the house, because I think with the exception of a few extracurriculars and school vacations, of course, most young people's lives are school, home, school, home, school, home, work, you know? So a change of scenery really might help with the transition. Now, I mentioned before trying to connect with other homeschool groups, unschool groups, but for me, that's just a way of maybe finding some support to alleviate feelings of alienation. But what I think you should also consider is looking for groups, and they could be youth groups, but they don't necessarily have to be, that are built around one of your child's interests. So even meetup.com might be a good place for this. Or start a group of your own with kids who do go to school, if you think your child can tolerate that. And most probably can, especially if they've had experiences in the public school built around some common interest. So I just throw those suggestions out there, hopefully as a way of providing some clarity to this whole exploration of what out-of-school learning options exist for your child. I really believe it's something that is worth considering. If you're like most parents, you are probably somewhat frustrated with the public school experience. If you are honest about your child's attitude towards that school experience, what other options might there be? All right, here's my conversation with Kevin Geary and Daryl Becker. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're new, thanks for checking out the show. And here we go.
All right, so, Brett, why don't we start with you and just your kind of Cliff Notes background of what you do and what your mission is.
Yeah, sure. So I think the most important thing is that I host the School Sucks podcast, and sorry about the name, but school does suck in many ways. It was always what the kids told me when I was a teacher, and I'll get to that part of my career in a second. But, you know, I named the show that primarily because of this recognition that I had working with kids who were about to leave high school, mostly tutoring them for the ACT or the SAT, and comparing those experiences with the ones I was having with my young nieces and nephews, and how curious and energetic, creative, and individualistic they were, and realizing that these were two groups on either side of the schooling process. And by the time, and I think I experienced this too when I was 17, 18 years old, school had sucked out all of those natural gifts, just the process of being there and being stuck in that routine and having so little control over your life or your work for such a great period of time can be really spirit crushing. So the podcast, you know, initially we dealt with what I believe the problems with school were. And after that, we have explored what real learning is. And I think that's going to be a big part of our discussion today. Other than that, I worked as a teacher for about 4 years and then a tutor, private tutor, for roughly another 6 years. And I gave that up to do the School Sucks Project exclusively about 2 years ago.
Excellent. And we've got Daryl Becker with us as well. How's it going, Daryl?
Hey, Kevin. Great to be back on your show.
And yeah, great to have you.
Yeah, I'm definitely wanted to give a little intro. So I am an acupuncturist and holistic healthcare professional living over on the Big Island of Hawaii. I'm also interviewed on a variety of podcasts covering the subjects of communications, empathy, and cognitive skill sets. I am also the parent of a 19-year-old who just started college, and I try to work with Brett on the School Sucks podcast as often as I can.
Excellent. And tell us a little bit about, you know, you have a 19-year-old daughter, just I guess some cliff notes on her educational experience.
Well, you know, luckily I did a nice thick show of that with Brett and her. That was a while ago. It was more than a year ago. So I could throw you a link for that one at some point. But in the nutshell, she started off going to a Montessori school when she was pretty little. And then she tried to transfer to the local public school elementary, which lasted for a few years till she was very displeased. And we pulled her right the hell out of there. So then she could begin a distance learning curriculum, which essentially is a homeschooling curriculum. And it was a fairly crappy type curriculum, but it gave her a way of organizing her own time and to be able to put a lot more time into other things. And then after she had decompressed from that for some years and some of the friends she had made went to a progressive style high school, she chose to enter that at ninth grade and finished as the valedictorian for that high school. And that was just recently. And then she took a gap year between high school and college to just decompress from all of that. And now she's starting over there in Clark University.
Excellent.
And that's in outside of Boston.
Yeah, I'm glad you reminded me that that episode existed. I remember listening to it originally, and I'm definitely going to put that in the show notes. That's probably going to be a must listen for the audience. Okay, so what do you guys think is like the foundational purpose of public school? And, you know, the stated purpose we know is education. But let's start to unwrap a little bit, you know, what you think the foundational purpose is, or maybe if they truly, truly wanted it to be about education, where has it kind of gone wrong?
All right. Well, I think the system was originally conceived. Earliest version of the system that we have today originated in Central Europe, and it was very much to indoctrinate obedience and a sense of nationalism above individualism. And it came to the United States in that form with many other purposes in mind. And I think that the man who's considered to be the father of public education in the United States, Horace Mann, was somewhat honest about the shortcomings of the European system, which was specifically Prussian. And he believed that America was unique and that formula of schooling could be used to good ends in the United States. About, 40, 50 years later, a group of progressive reformers came in and they wanted to, by and large, it's hard to generalize, but by and large, they wanted to take some of the regimentation out of the schools, but also, paradoxically almost, use the schools for their own type of regimentation that they thought would produce more of a, dare I say, socialist utopia as the 20th century went on. So it is very much about assimilating, outputting a fairly predictable populace. And it's not automatically anti-education, but that's kind of an outgrowth of having a system like that that is basically designed to scientifically manage a very diverse population, especially, you know, when we're talking about the turn of the 20th century, a diverse immigrant population. And it goes further off track from there, the increasing role of the federal government through the Department of Education. In the scheme of things, that's actually relatively recent. We're talking last 40 years. And there's also, I think, a second function of outputting employees for corporate interests, going all the way back to the industrial age. If people like the Rockefellers or like the Carnegies put into the school system, you know, thought and resources, they should be able to some extent, control the output. So that's part of it as well. The result, I don't want to say it's anti-education, but there's certainly a tremendous amount of missed opportunities. And because of all that, it does have more of an antinomous relationship with the word education or learning than it does consistency.
Yeah. And Daryl, you can chime in here too on this, but when I think of parents that I've known who had kids in the school system, and I hear Brett describe the Prussian model and where our current school system, the kind of the framework for it came from, and socialist tendencies and this and that. And then I think of the people who I know personally who have kids in the system, and what they see school as is this great place with very nice teachers, and their children get to go there for many hours a day, and they, you know, shoot to get good grades, and this is the way that their kids are going to get ahead in society. And they've bought in so completely that they are, in fact, helping the schools race their kids to the top, so to speak, quote unquote top, whatever that means. But they seem to have no notion of the Prussian model or any of the underlying framework or any other thing that may be going on that doesn't really have a lot to do with education and has mostly to do with obedience and preparing people to work in factories and so on and so forth.
Well, Kevin, I think that those who don't study history are indeed doomed to repeat it. I know that's a paraphrase, but that's essentially the problem right there. You have a lot of people who are following the motions, both in parenting and in doing what they think is right for their children. So there's a lot of indoctrination that has happened where people think that children cannot teach themselves, that a parent does not have anything valid or capable to teach to their child, that it requires a professional. There are a lot of myths, and we might be breaking some of them down today, but that's essentially the problem right there, the right to the top kind of attitude. And as someone who went through and tried my best and went into advanced placement classes that were absurdly challenging and took up obscene amounts of my time as a student, I got to experience what that was as far as the damage to myself and my physical body even, and things of that nature. I got to experience how it really damaged my skills, even socially speaking, for a little period of time, until I realized that that was to my benefit to not try so hard, perhaps. Like, I already proved that I was intelligent enough. But I have to say, though, that the same things that I saw as a student when I was young, as a child, I got to see again when I was a professor teaching acupuncture students. Those are people trying to get their master's degree, a master's of science in Oriental medicine. And the same lessons of obedience, conformity, and apathy were very well now ingrained in these master's students, these people who are coming to get their advanced degree so that eventually they can get a license of acupuncture. And I was seeing, of course, amongst the curriculum too, the same tons of repetitive, mostly unnecessary work that's just there to show how obedient and how conforming are these people. Will they follow through? Do they have that type of follow through and ability to recall and regurgitate what was given them? So, you know, the damage that happens to children can go for a long time, as I was teaching people in their late 20s, 30s, and older. And I just wanted to emphasize that right there.
What about with your daughter? I mean, when did you, I guess, how old was she when you realized, or maybe it was even before she was born, where you knew, you know, that you were going to pursue an alternative form of education for her?
You know, the thing is, unfortunately, I was still indoctrinated at that point to think that I didn't have the chops to help my daughter learn, or that she didn't even have the chops, like herself, to self-motivate and cipher and decipher letters and numbers. I did not understand that that was a built-in capacity to all children who are relatively undamaged. They don't need extra special focused professionals, basically. So all I knew was that the schooling I went through sucked, and I was going to make sure that she never experienced bullies or anything remotely that was a complete waste of her time. And I did my best amongst that, but at the same time, it became very clear to me that I was utilizing first daycare and then the actual schools that she was enrolled in as a form of daycare, as a way of having her someplace while I was at work and while her mom was at work. So that was a realization that happened kind of late on, and I knew something was wrong, but I really unfortunately did not get to implement it into my daughter's life in a practical way while she was amidst going through the schools that she was in. The only difference, of course, was that when she was pulled out of elementary school, when she was disturbed at seeing bullying happen, but reported that she never experienced it towards herself, and she was definitely having no friends there and seeing that it was just mostly a waste of her time and creative energy, it was a really good thing to pull her out halfway out of sixth grade and for her to have those several years of just arranging her own time, watching everyone else in her household leave to go to work while she just stays there and does the little bit of work that she wanted to do while pursuing her own interests of drawing and artwork and writing. So I got to see that in practicality. I got to see what type of distance. It was a Oak Meadow distance curriculum, and it was utter crap for the most part, you know, like a bunch of lies. And I got to sort of, you know, chime in on some of the, as far as how not consistent with reality some of the messages hidden within those things were. It was much later in my life. Basically, I came upon much of my studies of these things not until about 2009, at which point... not only did I live more than 5,000 miles away from my daughter, but she pretty much was on her own teenage track at that point.
Yeah.
So,
and what about you, Brett? Here you are working in the system. How long was it before you started scratching your head?
Well, it was a gradual process. It went through many different forms for many different reasons. Initially, I pretty much always worked in private education. And of course, there's a lot of public funding and public oversight, or government oversight, I should say. Public funding, but government oversight. The oversight is very not public. I started a boarding school when I was still in college. I was a med person for one of the dorms, or actually three of the dorms. So I was handing out all the pills to the kids who were in basically state care, and then sent to this private boarding school. So most of them were on Medicaid, and I was really stunned. I mean, even as a pretty obedient college graduate, I was pretty stunned with the number of pills I was giving out to some of these kids, some of them very young, like 10 years old. Over the course of a day, like I would work 14 hours on Sunday, and there was one kid, I would give him over 30 pills in a day. And, you know, like I've said a bunch of times on my show when telling the story, for not really any significant changes, noticeable changes anyway.
Were these for focus and that type of thing?
No, because a lot of these drugs weren't even school related. They were to deal with things like anxiety or depression. There was also a swallow the spider to chase the fly kind of effect, where one drug would have side effects and then another drug would be added to deal with side effects. So the more this troubled me, and I would talk to other people who work there, and then it would trouble me even more. So most of the realizations that I had about the system, I had even before that, like being a student. And, you know, then I went to college and I graduated from college very liberal and really believing in the system and believing that the system is where you need to go if you want to make a positive difference in the lives of others, and really being affected by what I saw while I was trying to make that difference. And I think over time that kind of put me in a position where I was remembering more and more of what my school experience was like. And then when I left those private schools and I moved out to the Boston, Massachusetts area, and I started doing academic tutoring and SAT tutoring, very much as an enforcer for the school, especially when it came to things like grades, I got a closer look at the public system. And I had other experiences, like, you know, I was in grad school around this time, a little before this, and stumbled across the work of people like John Holt and John Kozel and John Taylor Gatto. And so that was rattling around in the back of my head, these criticisms of school or the skepticism about the efficacy or even the intentions of the system itself. So it was a very gradual process. There was no really transformative event that happened in a short period of time. I think it was what I've described as learning my way out of one job after another. Like, I would just not really be motivated to do the work because I didn't believe it was having a positive impact. And, you know, I wasn't a visionary. I just felt like I was participating in hurting people, and that translated into me not feeling good when I went home from work every day. And I wanted something that was more meaningful and more enjoyable. And I had to change stations several times over the 12 years that I wound up spending in these systems to find something like that.
I want to hone in on what you said about kind of realizing it when you were in the system as a student, because, and I haven't put a ton of thought into this, but I'm sure there's different personalities, obviously, of students. And I'm sure there are some who, if they looked back and they put themselves in that chair again in school, that they could easily see the tension and the frustration and a lot of the things they experienced that should have been light bulb moments for them, that the system is not working. But there's also personalities who probably excelled in that environment for some reason or another, or enjoyed that environment, or feel like they got a lot out of it. And I'm wondering, I guess it's a two-part question, but for the people who felt like that was a positive environment for them, what is the message? And for the people who felt like it wasn't a positive environment and that the system is broken, maybe they've even forgot that that's how they felt, because the system does not ever say, you're right, there are problems with the system. I mean, very, very rarely do I ever hear people within the system really step up and say that. It's almost always, no, the students are broken, right? Mm. If you feel like the system is broken, that's your problem. You're not studying hard enough. You're not focused. You need more medication. You need to do your homework. You need to listen better, and on and on and on. It's always about how the student is not doing well in the system rather than the system not doing well for the student. So there's at least two personalities there. I'm sure there are more. But what are the message of these two different groups?
Well, I would just say from my experience, the system was there when I got there. You know, as a six-year-old, it seemed to be cruising right along. I was invited to participate in it as long as I could follow the rules and be polite and do what I was told. So there was never really any opportunity or any message even that I could question what was going on around me, what I internalized through the hardships that I experienced going through really K through 12 was that something was wrong with me, that I was defective, that I wasn't fitting in. And, you know, I mean, I got good grades throughout most of my education. I had friends, I did sports, but I always just felt like it was a really frustrating and a spirit-crushing kind of experience, that it was never going to end and there was nothing in it for me. Mm-hmm. And the internalization, like I said before, was what's wrong with me? It was never like a moment, whether I was 6 or 9 or 14 or 16, even when I became more skeptical of authority and pretty much outright anti-authoritarian. Like by the time I got to, you know, 12th grade, I was signing myself out of school by forging teacher signatures. But still, it was never like, oh, I see what's going on here. This is a defective system that's off course. You know, it was always something that was wrong with me. And on the other side, where people can do very well, you know, I mean, maybe that creates more opportunities as far as college or career, but it's not really an empowering message, I think, for either group, the school experience, because mine was something is wrong with me, I'm defective. The other one is, well, you're very good at collecting carrots. You're very good at collecting stickers on things. You're very good at getting A's. You're very good at pleasing other people. And I think a lot of a young person's sense of who he or she is external. You know, it's not about making meaning for yourself. It's not about intrinsic motivation. It's about pleasing other people. And that is, I don't want to say a sure way, but there's a pretty good chance that a person is going to lose his or herself in that experience. Now, that makes for very obedient workers, compliant bureaucrats, but that's not what I see the purpose of education as. So,
well, I'm glad you pointed out that part of your personality. My experience, because that brings a third then personality into the picture, and I want to ask Daryl what his kind of feelings were again going through school. Mine was, I never really felt like it was a problem with me. I remember constantly, and in elementary school, I was just completely clueless. I mean, I was in complete, like, just be obedient, do what everybody says mode. In middle school, I think the transition started to happen. And by the time I got to high school, it was always every single day, I was just like, this is fucking silly. Like, what are we doing here? And that was my basic philosophy or attitude towards it. So, Daryl, what was your experience like?
My experience, unfortunately, was that I found out that for anyone who was understanding and attached to what they were emotionally feeling, the schools that I went through were dangerous places. This was a place for people who were completely detached from what they were emotionally feeling. This was a place for people who could engage in either being a bully or being popular enough so that you could just watch the entertainment of the poor people who were bullied and the poor people who were bullying them. This was that type of an arena back in the 70s and 80s when I was in public school. So that is something right there. Now, if you happen to be one of those people who checked out emotionally, or you happen to have been very popular, you could just simply have gone through all of those years, those 15,000 hours, and said, school was great, it worked for me. Because, of course, that's what happens when you're missing key pieces of information. You just checked out of it. So I was in that little situation, you know, of being easily upset, easily crying. My home life was not perfect, had an alcoholic dad, that type of thing. So I was, you know, going between bullies at school and a dangerous father at home, you know, where I was worried I was going to get hit today. And that was that's a challenging arena to be in. And I definitely got to see and imagine what were some of the bullies, what were their lives like. And I got to see what the popular kids' lives were like. So the secret messages of obedience, conformity, and apathy, that of not even caring, is very insidious. And I listened to pretty much the entire audiobook of John Taylor Gatto's magnum opus, The Underground History of American Education, while I was going through, you know, like seeing what my daughter was doing homeschooling wise, and then eventually as she chose to enter a progressive high school. So seeing like that, unfortunately, there were those messages that are still squished in there. I think it's really important just to understand that there are real causes and effects going on. And it's sort of that lesson of studying economics. There's the seen and the unseen. And just because you might not be measuring a variable as a parent doesn't mean it's not having an effect on your child. So that's something I wanted to put out there as a little cautionary tale.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up the kind of environment of the public school system, you know, where we were talking a minute ago about seeing how the system itself is broken, but what is also broken is really the environment that kids are put in. And it's odd because that's one of the main arguments for proponents of public schools. Or when you talk about home educating your child, often somebody will make the socialization argument, right? Well, your child's not going to be socialized. And immediately what pops into my head, because you're right, I was bullied, right? I did not have a good experience in public schools. So the first thing that comes to my head is, so this person that's in front of me thinks that exposure to bullies and drugs and shame and an authoritarian obedience model and emotional neglect, you know, these are all examples of healthy socialization to them. I don't understand how it's missed by such a large percentage of the population. And now I know there is a percentage of the population that's like, yeah, that's what kids need, right? That's going to toughen them up. That's going to get them ready for society. But what do you guys think is just the general mindset of people? If they do see that, how can they still then send their kids to that situation?
Well, the society that they think they're preparing their children for by exposing them to this unhealthy environment is the society that people like us would very much like to see change. You know, so I think the starting point in that argument is that society is fine as it is now, and whatever challenges or hardships kids have to go through to be accepted into that, that's just part of the process. So I think that that's a place where, if I was having that argument with somebody, I'd like to stop them right there and really try to unpack that. Is society, are you really happy with how everything is functioning in society? You know, whether we're talking about culturally, politically, and then I think that would give you some indication as to whether or not that conversation should continue. You know, I mean, I'd be interested to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah, Daryl.
Yeah, I want to just add that that's the important part right there. Know who your audience is so you can tailor your message to them, because you're the author of your message, and it's very important to understand, did you lose your audience or do you still have them? Because if they are pretty happy with the world as it is, then I think that that's an interesting avenue to explore. If they are actually displeased of it, but they saw maybe some utility in, I would say, forcing their child to go through, to toughen up, fight off bullies, become the popular person, you know, get the cheerleader, all that whole nine yards. If that is indeed your goal, but you're still at the same time questioning it, questioning the end results, not quite happy with the whole society kind of thing, which I see from, you know, my experience having talked with many, many people at this point, being I'm 43, so I've spent some time just gathering notes. I would gather that there's a lot of people who would simply sign off on the idea that there are things wrong with society. I will just want to add that there are societies. I mean, I went to school in Westchester, New York, kind of upper class, basically. I was not in, like, Harlem, New York City. I was not going through that kind of thing, or like South Central LA or something. There are many different societies going on. But I think that what Brett mentioned as far as the Prussian education system, or that which came from Central Europe and that which then was duplicated and spread throughout the world, that is a type of zeitgeist or mindset, a spirit of the age, which is incredibly prevalent. And to actually look at how the cause and effect of the adopting of those procedures and those mindsets, how that affects ourselves and our children, is a very uncomfortable emotional situation for many people. And it's going to bring up that two-word phrase, cognitive dissonance. So if you're going to bring this one up with a parent, for example, and that's a very, very touchy subject for a parent about their choice of educating their child, I think it'd be very important to understand, to see, is there any cognitive dissonance going on? Meaning, is this person that you're speaking with having competing ideas going on in their mind, where at one point they're trying to justify toughening up their child, and at another point they're disappointed with how the world has ended up? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But what about the people who aren't in a position of, I want to toughen up my child? They just feel that school is a great place, and maybe it's because there's not a lot of depth in their critical thinking, or maybe they're just ignoring. If they do start to realize, they immediately turn like the thought process off, because some of these things can be excused away, like bullying. Okay, I'll join the PTA. I'll be involved in my child's school / education, right? Drugs. Oh, we have a resource officer. They're taking care of that problem, right? Shame. No, there's not really a lot of shame. You know, I think my kid just, you know, needs to let it slide off their back a little bit. The teachers have a lot of kids to handle. An authoritarian obedience model. Nah, I don't really see much of that going on. Emotional neglect. No, that's just that term. That's way too, you know, descriptive of what's actually happening here. I think it's all pretty much just fine. It's not perfect, because nothing can be perfect. Like, they can just keep excusing it away every single time.
You know what you left out there, Kevin, that's interesting, is anything about learning.
Yes.
So there's a lot to go through, and hearing about somebody's own school experiences, especially somebody who would give you some of those lines or all of those lines, again, would be interesting for me. But a question I raised with a group of people one time is, aside from basic reading, basic writing, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and fractions, what would you say are the three most important things you learned in your 12 years of school?
Yeah, and that's a question that I've asked myself, and yeah, that I still am having trouble sorting out.
Now, even if they have their three things, there's a pause there, right? Where some introspection can and probably will take place, I think, for most people. I certainly saw a lot of introspective faces when I asked a group of people that question, and they didn't have three things.
Right.
And there was, you know, five or six of them. And I don't think three things were generated. I'm sure it was brushed off or the subject was changed, but I don't remember getting my three things that I asked for.
Yeah, and there's also the other side of it, of what didn't they learn, in terms of like what could they have experienced,
yes,
during those. That's 12 years of time. 12 years of time. What could they have experienced? And that was one of the reasons that I was so frustrated with the system when I was in it, because I was like an entrepreneur at heart. What was I learning about entrepreneurship? Zip, nada, nothing. I wasn't learning anything about personal finance. I wasn't learning anything about basically how to live in the real world. I was just following somebody else's script of, you need to learn a lot, or I'm sorry, a little about a lot of things, mm-hmm, right? Here's a lot of things. You need to know a solid amount about each thing. That way, when you go out into the world, you can kind of choose what you're going to do, and you'll have a little bit of a foundation to go do that. Whereas I wanted to like study the things that I wanted to study, that I was actually interested in. And my parents are like, why are you getting bad grades? And I constantly told them, I'm getting bad grades because I'm not interested in this stuff. Like, it's not fun to me.
Right. And I would say we're looking at it mostly at the problem angle of it. And I can see that there's a lot of ways to excuse away the problems like what you just mentioned, Kevin. There's all these ways of finding of, well, see, it's good enough like this, and it's kind of working like that, and that type of thing. And yeah, I guess there's kind of a problem with, I guess a lot of time is spent on getting this broad spectrum of knowledge that has small utility value. I think that what I would probably wish to focus on were I to talk with someone and actually wish to show them some positive benefit of where I'm headed with this discussion, I would probably aim to say that I can see evidence from my research and from the research that Brett's done and many other people that there's a much more effective way to help our children get a serious edge in this 21st century world. That is 20th century, really old school. It's even older than that. It's 19th century design system. And it's really, really old. It's broken. It's designed to create an obedient worker that just follows along and is hired by someone like you, Kevin. Someone who just, you know, you're ready to, like, you know, be signing the front of a paycheck and know all of the ins and outs of that. But that would be right there, is like to start selling on what are the advantages of autodidactic education, of a child-directed learning system, and that would be what I want to inject in the discussion.
Okay, so that's a perfect segue then into, I mean, what's supposed to be the main topic, pretty much the differences between school and education. So that's it, right? When Brett earlier said, you know, the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic, schooling is an extrinsic thing, and education should be an intrinsic thing, right? So who should be responsible? Who should really do the work of educating kids? Would the answer be the kids?
Well, a great way to bring this into focus too, just to go back to this imaginary person we're kind of trying not to argue with here, a great question is, how do you learn, adult? When you want to know something new, who grabs you and forces you to do X, Y, and Z to work towards mastery? You know, so I think when we talk about unschooling or authentic education, we're just talking about the way adults learn things pretty much for the rest of their lives after school, if they have any desire left to learn anything that is not specifically, employment related. And there's plenty of that in spite of school. You know, there is plenty of adults learning on their own. So asking people to reflect on what that process is for them is an important step in discovering how it could be translated to younger people.
Well, maybe this is where Daryl can expand on something he said earlier, which is the built-in capacity to learn. I mean, this is the fundamental reason why unschooling works, right? Is that right, Daryl?
Right. And unschooling, I think the term came from John Holt, if I believe correct. And so that just basically is saying the same thing as I just said when I said autodidactic education or child-directed education. And it was discovered by a variety of researchers, including John Holt, John Taylor Gatto, I guess the other Jonathan Kozol, all the John researchers, basically. Many other people besides, the work of Dana Martin, that type of thing. This is a very, very well-researched type of thing where the children have within them a vast capacity to focus, to find things of their own interest, and it all comes back to the same ciphering and deciphering of letters and numbers, which allows them massive computer access, massive information access, practical know-how access, and from there, then they just move on to study in small or large groups with actual adult professionals to continue on their actual education. So there are many people who are proponents of so-called unschooling, that they use the term unschooling. Some people like home education, or some people prefer just simply child-directed education, since it's not necessarily always at home. They're definitely taking it out there, and there are definitely groups of people who are getting together with their children, just allowing the venue and then providing the resources and small bits of guidance to help additional procedures go along, to help with projects, to help to give the benefit. this is a strange idea, but the idea is that the same thing that's within the adult who can teach themselves whatever skill you can name right now, they just can go right to YouTube and see someone teach you how to do whatever you want, including pretty much everything I know about Oriental medicine and holistic medicine. Everything is all out there just to learn if you wanted to. It would just take the time to intrinsically from within learn how to do that. I think that the apathy factor that is just learned by people who are sitting powerless facing this whiteboard or blackboard or facing the teacher essentially, and to sit through these small segments trying to find the value and often missing it, there's a sense of apathy that's grown within a child facing that. And many home educators who go through that, you know, autodidactic self-education promoters, they would look at that and say, okay, your child needs to decompress if they've been through public school. Because the procedure that goes, what happens damage-wise going through public school is insidious. And I wouldn't necessarily bring that up in every discussion with every parent if they're not ready to hear about that. Because again, cognitive dissonance, that's going to be emotional if they have to even entertain the idea for a moment. But I would probably do the Socratic method, asking questions. If you wish to have someone help their child and hopefully remove their child from a coercive situation, which they could probably do much better on their own, then that would be a beginning point. How do you learn? Just as Brett asked.
Yeah. And you talked about the built-in capacity, but there's also the built-in motivation, because right when Brett talked about asking people how they learn, asking adults how they learn, I can imagine the argument to that would be, but I'm an adult. I have discipline and I know what needs to be done. Therefore, I do it. And if I trust that my child will do the same thing, well, no, that won't actually happen. They will play video games all day. They won't have any motivation to learn. They will grow up and they won't be able to read and they won't be able to write, and I'll be a complete failure as a parent.
Well, that's
I've heard that for sure.
And you're
I wanted to respond.
Go ahead.
Just from the perspective of what I saw with my daughter. So I, like all parents, you know, I saw my daughter drawing her whole life. But what really took off was when she was pulled out of public school, when she was pulled out of that public elementary school, and then just doing this, you know, like spent maybe a couple hours every day doing that Oak Meadow distance curriculum. And then the rest of the time, she focused in drawing and eventually in writing in such a profound, focused way that I just saw that that was all right there inside of her. I didn't have to sit there and just like correct her or show her how. Once she had the very basics, she sought out greater and greater facility and knowledge on her own. I certainly saw that. And I saw it with her friends who were also doing that, where they were going through that same curriculum, and then they would have all this spare time to develop their own personal interests. Now, what happens, unfortunately, in public school is, which is one of those questions I would raise, is how many hours in school and how many hours out of school fulfilling the busy work? I got to dish out busy work when I was a professor teaching acupuncture students as they were going through to get their master's. I was the one dishing out more busy work like that. It was an unfortunate situation, but I tried to make it as easy as possible, given the fact that they had to pass those courses and the subsequent ones after that, as well as their board exam. So this was just something that I see as a lesson that's given in there. If a child is already going through many, many hours, then that does look really tough. But it doesn't take that many hours to really achieve mastery. It's not so much I think Brett has more stats on this one, but the number of hours that a child who really, really tries to do well and follow the system of public school, it is really absurd and obscene. It's like a lot of hours of waking up early, getting prepared, going to school, being through all those classes, all of the assignments from each of those classes, then home, maybe some extracurricular activities as well to move their body, and then homework up until the brink of absolutely losing sleep, and then waking up all over again. Now, that's traumatic. And that is something right there to measure the number of hours that a child actually goes through. If your child is experiencing something traumatic, can you have the facility to first be aware of that, to measure it, and maybe hopefully take steps? I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, and you didn't even get into the drugs and the bullying and all that yet, you know, when you add that on top of the, you know, the trauma that is public schooling.
Just the robbery of
time. But you were about to jump in, Brett.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, simply put, and I think this builds nicely on what Daryl said, when people make those predictions about their children in the future, they'll just play video games, as you said, Kevin, I think they're using or they're viewing their schooled child in the present to make that prediction about what they would do with more freedom, or using or viewing their schooled selves in the past, right? So yeah, what else? What else would they do? What do you want to do after what Daryl just described? Like, if right. suddenly you had control over your own life for an hour a day, yeah, maybe it would be Grand Theft Auto. Maybe that would feel really nice. Maybe that would be a much needed decompression. I mean, it's not like young people don't have free time. And I mean, I remember being in middle school and I remember being in high school and having some free time, but I knew it was going to end. I knew it was finite. I knew that it was often created as the result of procrastination. Like, there was homework I needed to be doing that I wasn't doing because I needed that time to myself instead. So, yeah, I think that that's a reasonable prediction that a lot of people make. They won't do anything productive. Well, it's because the only way that they're being taught to do anything productive is basically under duress.
Right.
Yeah.
So how would you define education, Brett?
Well, in this context, where we're talking about what education actually is and why schooling isn't it, education, wanting your child to have an education, requires much more trust, I think, in this natural learning process. You know, I forget who said it, but the best teacher we're ever going to have is the one inside, and it's curiosity. And you have a young child, right, Kevin, like 3 years old?
Yes.
Okay. So I think, through observing children that age, we can see they act purposefully. Even if, like, their tasks, like, oh, look, she took the cushions off the couch and made it in, like, a pen and then put stuffed animals inside the pen. Like, to an adult who has to, you know, do their taxes or fill out TPS reports, yeah, that all seems very vapid, like taking the cushions off the couch right. and putting stuffed animals inside it. But little children do those things purposefully because they're trying to make meaning out of the world around them, and they're also trying to exert some control over the world around them and get a sense of efficacy. So creating more opportunities where that natural process can take place, because school is sit still, right? School is obey. School is fill this out. So the definition of education, I think, is something that for our purposes here might have to unfold over the course of the discussion, and I'm interested to hear what Daryl has to say. But first and foremost, I would say it requires that whoever is supervising that person, whoever is wanting an educated child to come out of this experience, it must start with a trust in the natural learning process. There's lots of other attributes of education that separate it from school, like learning feels good, learning doesn't require anyone being forced to do anything, learning is often accidental. Learning is best when it is the most meaningful for the learner. Learning can be happening all the time. It is not set to a 7-hour block of time during a child's day or whatever time they have to do added on to that for homework. And I think it often is done in a less pressured environment, or it often happens, I should say, in a less pressured environment. So there's lots of attributes of learning, too, that separate it from school, because none of those attributes describe the school experience.
Right. And how would you define it, Daryl?
I would define education as a process that is built into all children and adults of knowing the names and parts of things, or acquiring that knowledge, and then understanding the connection between those things, and then seeing and applying the practical applications of that knowledge and understanding. It's very basic, and it's built into all children. So you can certainly see this with a 3-year-old. I saw it certainly with my own daughter, that of where they get the names for everything. They get the names for everything. They get generalized names, and then they get specific names for specific things. And they begin to understand the next step, which is interrelationships, which we call logic, or decision-making processes, which comes from logic. And that is the relationship between those things in the abstract as an idea. And then there's the practical applications of those things. So I certainly covered that one when I discussed a little one who's learning how to make a fire, something I got to see my daughter learn how to do when I lived with her in Vermont, a very important thing, making a fire. She learned all the pieces of the fire, the paper, the kindling, the little sticks, the bigger sticks, the small logs, the big logs. Then she learned the logic, how to stack them in such a way as to make a fire that's going to actually burn well in the wood stove or in the fireplace. And then from there, the next step is actually doing it. And getting a part wrong shows, oh, this is how to make a smolder fire. See, it's not really bursting into fire. This is a different kind of fire. Or it's not so much wrong as it has a different application, because there's times where you want a smolder fire, where you want to walk away from the campsite and come back to still having something on fire. So it all comes down to that.
Sorry, in school that would be wrong. But
you
got an F on making the fire I asked you to make. You actually made a different type of fire that's useful in certain situations. But for these purposes, you have an F.
Right. And there you see like the application of grades. Knowledge comes down to just a bit of all of the things of the parts that are eventually going to be used for a practical application. The understanding is the connections between those things. And then from there, it all is based on practical application. So I didn't see my daughter go through stacks and stacks of books of how to draw. I saw her emulate drawings, her trying to copy drawings. And I think minimal research on her part and then just, you know, getting more and more stellar. I didn't see her going through lengthy essays and books on how to write an expository essay. I saw her do it. I saw her get better and better at it. I didn't see her studying all the intricacies of plot development and character. I saw her write fiction and get better and better at it and continue to. A lot of it is in doing, and there's a lot of resources out there for increased doing. But yeah, that was in the long way, that was me trying to describe education, which, as we can see, is very different from schooling.
Yeah, and I like the combination of both of the answers that you gave, and using those in combination, my question would be, can real, like, authentic education ever come from the schooling model?
What do you think, Daryl?
I'm just shaking my head. That standard schooling model is, I think, like Jacques Fresco would say, she's got to go. You know,
it can't have... go ahead, sorry.
It's just not... It's not going to work. It's going to go away. It will go away. And just like monopolies everywhere, they're all going to go away because monopolies will be supplanted by pluralities. So when you have one obligatory monopoly providing a service, that's the general economic principle. At first, it might look really cool because you have people entering it from the diversity of a plurality. When you begin your monopoly service, it's entered into by professionals coming from a plural services, from different competing companies and collaborating companies. But either way, they're separate. And then over time, you get a lower and lower quality at a higher and higher price. That's what you see here. So that's my answer.
It could never have all of the attributes that I described happening in school, you know, especially the coercion one. School mm-hmm. is coercive. So I think that the trivium process that Daryl described could obviously take place in that setting. I think I like Daryl's definition as it was more practical and mechanical, and mine focused maybe a little bit more on the emotional. And both of those things, I think, are very, very important. But the mechanical part can, and I think does to a certain extent, take place in some aspects of schooling. But the intrinsic motivation and emotionally rewarding aspects of learning, that's going to be much, much harder to achieve in that setting.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the foundation of public schools, I mean, number one, they don't ask you if you want to attend, right? They don't ask you what you want to learn when you're there. It's all decided for you. It's decided that you're going to go, and it's decided what you're going to quote unquote learn. And to me, like, those two obstacles right from the beginning are too much to overcome if you're talking about getting people an authentic education.
Right.
So I know this is probably a pet peeve of yours, Brett, but people thinking, okay, I get it. I want to do something different. I'm going to homeschool my kids, which to them, or I guess the product of that, is they just bring the school system into their house.
Well, they bring some of it, but not all of it. So if I had to say anything about it positive, it's a step away from certain dangers. But as Laurette Lynn said, you know, only school can do school. And my conversations with her really encouraged me to move away from the phrase unschooling towards home education or authentic education. So yeah, I mean, people do that, and it could definitely strengthen family relationships as long as the same pressures aren't applied. Because one of the things that I saw a lot in my tutoring work is that parents had to basically line up with the school against their own children. That can really fracture family relationships. But then I guess there's also the risk of that happening in the household, where now mom or dad is the teacher and the authority and the administrator of the schooling experience. So ideally, I would really like to see people skip over the homeschooling and move right into, I don't even like home education, because I think so many of the most enriching experiences aren't going to happen at the kitchen table, you
right.
know? So I think that authentic education, real world education, is one that I really like. I would like to see people be able to wind up there as soon as they decide that the public school system is not the right place for their children.
I kind of thought about how I was going to describe it for my daughter in the easiest way, which may end up, maybe I don't even have to get into conversations with people, but it was just going to be like a, you know, the golly gee face and just say, well, she's getting educated. Like, and that's it. Like, she's just getting educated. I don't know. What is it called? It's called living. It's called being a human being. Like, human beings self-educate all the time, unless they've been schooled for a very long time and they're just done because they don't have any more, like, emotional juice to give towards themselves and furthering their development. But for the most part, if they haven't been, you know, tortured, then they have that intrinsic motivation to constantly learn. And that's it. That's from birth to death, really. So there is no, you know, everybody's trying to compartmentalize all the time and put things in nice little neat boxes where, oh, it's an education that happens at home because it's not happening at school. So it must be happening at home, rather than, let's just say, it's happening. It's just happening. That's it. It doesn't have a location.
Yeah, I would want to add that I like the term child-directed learning.
Yep.
It is mm-hmm. not too hard, not like autodidactic education. You know, that's just too hoity-toity for most people. So I go for that one. I'm trying to switch over and not use autodidactic too often now. I'm trying to change all of my $5 words to 10-cent words if I can. And I also, sometimes I do, you know, I definitely in discussing this, I've in the past, I think I encountered this, and there was that question of like, well, how does your child learn anything? And I like to interpret that question and give it a nice, honest answer of, well, wait, maybe you want to understand her educational accomplishments? Sure. Here, I'll show you one of her essays. I'll show you a story she wrote. I'll show, you know, like that demonstrates it. I'll show you how she balanced my checkbook. You know, you want to see this? You know, like, I mean, these are real life things that actually can be demonstrated. Children have a desire to use these awesome electronic tools, which all requires the ciphering and deciphering of letters and numbers in the proper order to get things done. So we don't yet like have a lot of computers that are completely voice activated that will just do all the work for you. This is not Idiocracy, where you have glyphs to touch and people, you know, with slack jaws looking around at like befuddling electronic equipment that they could never ever repair or replace. This is this world where it requires real typing of letters and numbers, and they are motivated to learn those letters and numbers so that they can enter that world. So that would be something I would always like to put out there. Like, huh, I never thought about that. Children want to use these tools. And in order to use these tools, they need to understand the letters and numbers. So just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, there's two social arguments that I wanted to hit on, because I know that people can come around to grasping the arguments for their own children and decide, okay, yes, this is going to be right for us. We're definitely going to divert attention away from the public school system. We're going to go to more of a child-directed learning model. But then there's still these harder social arguments that I hear all of the time when I have these discussions. And the first one is, without schools, you know, we're going to have basically a society of uneducated people, because regardless of, you know, whether parents actually have the capacity to facilitate a child's authentic education, the question is, will they, and will they in great enough numbers? And do we really want a society of uneducated people walking around?
Well, I would say you definitely have a society of unschooled people, but that in no way translates to uneducated. And I think, you know, that's difficult, because we look at what society looks like right now. We turn on the television or the Video Music Awards, the MTV Video Music Awards. You know, if people believe the 15,000 hours that people spend in school is synonymous with education, I think there'd be a lot of head scratching, you know, about a great many observations in our current society, in culture. The tools are there, and Daryl obviously touched on that. It is very, very easy to self-educate. I think that, you know, one of the observations I've made just in the last 15 years is it used to, back in the day, take a lot of work to be learned. And today, it seems like it almost takes a little bit of extra exertion to remain ignorant. Like, you really kind of have to steer your way around just, you know, waterfalls of information and learning opportunities. So I think the time is right to really embrace this idea. And when people talk about things like kids not going to school, not getting socialized, I mean, that argument is like from the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, that is so not applicable. And that is a very, very, whether you want to talk about the non-socializing aspects of school or all of the opportunities that exist for kids to actually interact with adults and mentors outside of the schoolhouse or school compound. Either way, you win that argument today very easily, I think. So there's a lot of very, very rich opportunities for this philosophy of education to work very, very well for a great number of people in this time.
I probably should have asked both questions at the same time, because the second question kind of ties in with the first question, or the second argument. So the second argument is, some kids need school as a safe haven because their home life is that bad that they don't have any other place to go. Like, public school is this place where they can get on the bus and, yeah, school sucks or it's not perfect, but you know what? It's 10 times better than what they experience at home. And tying in with the first argument, it goes that, you know, if kids are only concerned with not being beat and being safe and not joining gangs and selling drugs, like, there isn't enough time or capacity for them to worry about self-educating without schools, because all that will be left is, I don't want to get beat today, and I don't want a gang to initiate me, and I don't want to have to sell drugs. Like, there is no capacity for self-education in a lot of kids' lives. So the social argument is, we need schools because it saves kids from that scenario.
Yeah, Daryl, go ahead, please.
I think I would just wish to respond in the same way as, you know, like, we need pharmaceutical drugs because the devastating diseases that people would then, you know, really, really suffer if we stopped, like, the sudden supply of pharmaceutical drugs, well, then that situation is going to be made much worse. It's a similar type of argument, meaning that it is certainly, yeah, like, I definitely heard this argument from a friend of mine, lives over here, and she experienced that where, you know, her home life was traumatic, and she was very grateful that she got to escape that periodically 5 days a week just to go to school. And I do get that. I think that the innovative aspect of people, as we, like, we're three people, we're somewhat intelligent, we're able to figure things out, we're able to connect, we're able to be creative, we can innovate things. People can innovate solutions that still provide places for people to get together. And over here, there are several unschooling groups of parents who come together. They still use that word unschooling, but they get together and they provide opportunities for their children to mix together, to then get some small bit of guidance from an adult who happens to have some speciality. And of course, all of it is optional, like the degree that they put their interest level in. And these are popping up everywhere. And I'm living fairly rurally out here in the Puna district of Big Island of Hawaii. Anywhere where there's an actual metropolis, there's oodles now of unschooling groups going on right now. And those are places where a child could also go away and get away from an unhappy and unfortunate home situation. So whenever there's an obstacle, I think it's very good to look and see how many different situations can provide to remedy that obstacle. How many opportunities, new businesses, new artistic expressions can be created from just looking at that obstacle? Because if you only look through the one lens of, bad home life, must have school, like everything looks like a nail when your only tool is a hammer. Just wanted to leave it with that.
I wanted to add something to that too. And my answer is, to me, it's a little unsatisfying and incomplete, and it has a little darkness to it. But I really think that this is going to be a very, very gradual change. And I think a small group of people, as is the case with any revolution, are going to have to be vanguards for the embrace and the spreading of this educational philosophy. So when somebody throws a question at us like, yeah, but what about the worst neighborhood in the country? You know, I see that as kind of an effort to derail the introduction of a political philosophy or an educational philosophy. Like, oh, well, use your thinking or use your vision or your utopia to solve what's going on in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, can't we get a little bit of a running start first? And I mean, those problems are significant. And I do feel that in a lot of these discussions, they are often overlooked. But I think that these ideas need to be embraced and then spread first by the people who are the most capable of embracing them and spreading them. And I think that in the long run, and I do believe it is going to be a long run, that will start to lift society in a larger way. I mean, we need public schools for everybody because of what the situation is in poor, inner city, minority, immigrant, or rural, white, poor neighborhoods. So everybody needs to continue to be compelled into the same system. And I think that pulls everybody down. And, you know, I've lived in places where there was a lot of like rural white poor people. I've lived in places where there was, you know, a large poor minority or immigrant community. These are groups that have had things handed to them for the better part of half a century at this point, and it got them to here, you know?
Yeah.
And so just to say, no. More and more handouts for them. Now, I'm not saying push a button and shut down the public school system tomorrow. I think that would be fairly chaotic. And I've worked with a lot of these kids who were better off not in their homes. But just because we don't have a way to solve their problems yet, you know, or a way to circumvent what the state's attempts to solve their problems has, the hole that that's actually created, it doesn't mean that our discussion and our exploration has to stop.
Well, yeah, my argument would be, and has been, first of all, we don't have solutions to those edge cases because we have the public school system.
I think, like, that's part of it. Yeah.
The default solution, right? Well, people are like, well, the school system is there. That is the solution. We don't need another solution. But yeah, I've used the same argument more eloquently, but here, you know, just saying we don't have to terrorize an entire nation of children just to give the edge cases a better life for 12 years. You know, like we can easily come up with a private solution to helping kids out who need help, who need a safe haven. This having keeping this monstrosity around and all the harm it does to everybody else is not a viable option.
Yeah.
That's right. And I would add that there's no need to have to even focus on getting rid of that system or concern that it's going to suddenly disappear.
Right.
Because there's a behemoth of many billions of dollars ready and willing and very interested in keeping it in place. I think what is popping up more and more are the pluralistic solutions to the obstacles that that situation creates. And that's what I would emphasize.
Well said. Absolutely. Yeah.
So last kind of angle on this topic, over the next 15 years, what do you see happening and what would you like to see happen? And I'll just start out from my point of view. I think that anybody who is buying into the public school system at this point is not playing the long game. I don't think that the public school system will exist. Now, the argument that Daryl just made about the amount of money and the amount of influence that's in the system and how they are incentivized to keep the current system around is very powerful and is very strong. But I think that technology, if allowed to continue at the pace that it is, I know there's talk about government taking over internets and things like that, but if it is allowed to continue at the pace that it is, I don't see public school existing in its current form in 15 years from now. So I think a lot of the talk about what do we do about it, I think it's already being done too. Like it just is a model that cannot compete and it's going to lose in the face of, I mean, you're already seeing the online education options for adults in creativelive.com and I can't think of the other sites' names right now, lynda.com, but there's an immense amount of sites that are dedicated just simply to educating adults on whatever they want to know and whatever they need to know to become more economically valuable. And the same exact model is going to happen for kids. And I don't think the public school system, like I don't think libraries are going to be able to survive it. But I definitely want to hear what you think, Brett and Daryl as well.
Well, I would add just a caveat to what you said around the word compete. Public schools don't compete, they can't compete, and they don't need to. And I know you know this, Kevin, and you know this, Daryl, but just for anyone who's new to these ideas, like say two of us are playing tetherball, right? And Kevin, you're winning, but then I start waving a gun around, right? I win. And that's basically how the advantage that the public schools have over alternative forms of education. Bad money will continue to be pumped into those systems until the government collapses down on top of it. You're talking about the collapse of the entire government structure for the public school to not exist anymore, I believe. So we still do have to explore the growing alternatives and the embrace of those alternatives by an increasingly frustrated public of parents and students, right?
But don't you think I think it's... So if it does exist in 15 years from now, mm-hmm. I think it's going to enlighten people further. Hopefully they're paying attention. But if the internet is capable of easily providing the resources that kids need to self-educate and for parents to facilitate that, and it's really cheap, and we have the government over here with their monopoly on schooling, their monopoly on the school system, basically, is what you're saying. Mm-hmm. They are trying to then, what, make rules about who can use this internet-based learning model, who has to still show up. I think at some point people are going to say, why do they want our kids so bad? Like, here is the solution over here, and they won't let us have it. I think, like, the government has to show itself in that regard because they don't regulate the internet. Like, that is – the internet is the equalizer. It doesn't – I don't care about your monopoly over here, Mr. Government, because I have the internet, and you're not regulating that, so I'll do what I wish. Like, you can pretend you have whatever you want to pretend you have over here, but the internet exists separate from you. And that's the model that I'm going to go with. And I think that once enough people make that transition, the government has no choice. They're either going to have to relent, or they're going to have to become even more authoritarian to the point where people really wake up and say, wow, okay, you're stepping over the line here.
Yeah, so in this attrition, I'm wondering what that number has to be. And these were questions we were asking here in New Hampshire like 5 years ago, where as an experiment, if we could get a certain number of children within one district to leave the public school, how long would it be before they could no longer justify their budgets? And we started to almost role play play this in a sense, where some of us were bureaucrats still trying to defend the public system. And it's saying, you know, this these kids leaving, it must just be that the schools are, you know, not doing enough. And that's probably because they're so darn underfunded. You know, I mean, I could see that kind of argument happening lateral to all kinds of public relations efforts. Sorry to be cynical, but all kinds of public relations efforts directed towards marginalizing or crazifying anybody who is seeking alternatives outside of the system. So we have to look at where we stand now and say, what are the stigmas attached to homeschoolers in the United States? What is the average American public school believer picture when they hear the term homeschoolers? How does homeschooling play in the mainstream media or even in popular culture, in television shows? Oh, he's homeschooled. You know, so there is still very much an uphill battle here. And you're absolutely right, Kevin. Like in a rational world, in 15 years, it's impossible to understand how public school would exist in a rational world. But that's, from everything that I've gathered, that's not our world. So will public school adapt and try to take the form of more desirable or more effective learning alternatives that are in place online and are available at a very, very low cost? I'd like to see that, but from what I've learned so far, that would not be my prediction, quite honestly.
That would actually be more dangerous, I think, to me. I mean, I would not want the public school system to try to, you know, co-opt that model to take it.
Sure.
and keep kids trapped in, because of course there's still nothing is self-directed at that point. I think they would take the resources and technology and just use it to tell kids what they need to know, right? And still test them the way that they do. And they would just carry out the same model in a different form. And yeah, I mean, I absolutely see the argument that you're making. It's not that I think you're wrong. It's I hope you are. Like,
no, me too.
I really want to put my faith in the people in this regard, and I'm only doing so because I'm not afraid to be wrong. There's a very high chance that I'm going to be wrong, but I'm not afraid to be wrong. So, Daryl, go ahead.
Well, I identified a bunch of things in this discussion so far, this last part of it. There are many obstacles that are created by the public school monopoly. And that's just a given, that if you have a monopoly that's been going on this long, it's going to create all of these obstacles. And so this is the opportunity that's popping up for all of the entrepreneurs and the innovators who see the obstacle as a business opportunity, as a way to go forward. Just as a quick example, centralized fiat system of money is an obstacle, especially when there's all of these charges, fees, taxes, and things like that, and the tracing and movement, and basically the skimming off of the top, the bottom, and the middle. That is an obstacle. So people used cryptography and came up with an opportunity, a business opportunity. They invented Bitcoin and then all of the plethora of other cryptocurrencies, so-called, these digital commodities, digital real estate that is moved around and made secure to get around that obstacle. So as to go back to schooling, for example, the obstacle that one of the primary obstacles that the whole thing presents is childcare. People are using school as a daycare. So there are many rules right now, too many statutes and laws everywhere that just keep trying to clamp down and limit the available childcare out there, making it more pricey and expensive and more difficult for someone to operate. So that's an obstacle for someone to now innovate a way, a gray market or black market way around that, just to deliver the services that people desire for that. The other one, of course, is the PR effort of simply that child-directed learning is highly superior. My unschooling child is hiring your honor student. is a bumper sticker. That's just one thing right out there, that there is right now a PR campaign to begin to open people's minds to say, oh, yeah, actually, that's right. I would really like my child to have an edge over all the other children out there. Like, they don't need to be pushed down. I can help them get a leg up right now. So that's an opportunity right there. And then, of course, the eventual co-opting of child-centered learning in the first place as a model, and yet still making it a compulsory, monopoly, forced tax collection-based system, you know, that's another opportunity right there, as the pushback can eventually happen. Anything goes wrong with the internet, there's mesh networks. You could just simply put in your search engine, mesh, you know, internet mesh networks. And you see that there's already been workarounds to get around any centralized, I would say, monopoly government coercion, you know, that would, I would say, squeeze or tighten the information flow, digitally speaking. Each of these things is an opportunity for those who can just calm down, not be incredibly angry towards those who are engineering these tragedies, and just take a moment, get together with like minds, or find people who've already come up with a solution, because you could just enter it into your search engine. Chances are, whatever the obstacle is, someone out there has already been working to innovate a solution for it. So I don't know what's going to happen in 15 years. I can say, though, that totalitarian-wise, I mean, I'm sitting here over in Hawaii watching things go on around the world, and I'm seeing positives and negatives. You know, I'm not just looking at police brutality videos, that's for sure. I'm seeing a lot of benefits. I'm seeing a lot of people waking up in general. I'm feeling fairly optimistic. I can envision a pushback from these powerful monopolies that I've described. And I would just say that that's just another business opportunity for those who are poised to not just to make a profit from it, but they're poised to help people out. And that's the way I'm trying to summarize this.
Love it. Any final thoughts, Brett?
I just want to say how fantastic I thought Daryl's answer was.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
I agree.
I wish I had said that. That was much more positive. And there is There's plenty to be positive about. Yeah. There's plenty to be positive about. My answer neglected that.
Yeah, I liked your answer too, Brett, because, you know, personally speaking, here's another thing I wanted to just throw out there. For those of you who are parents, like myself and like Kevin, please ask people who are not parents and take their advice regarding your children, because they were children too. Assuming that they were children who had parents, then they received the services that you're dishing out to your child. So humble yourself and ask for how would you, you know, from advice from people who are not doing it. Obviously, you can add a grain of salt and, you know, not saying you're going to do everything that a non-parent is suggesting you do, but I am saying that open your mind to taking information from these people who had parents, because if you're dishing out the service, then those people who had received the services, they're the perfect people to give you some feedback, especially the closer they are to being a child, meaning the younger they are, the closer their memory is to those things.
Yeah. Awesome. Love it. Well, I want to thank you guys so much for coming on today. Brett, definitely tell everybody where they can find you and your work.
Absolutely. My website is schoolsucksproject.com, and you can check out all the different podcast series we've done there. If you come to the site wanting to learn something specific, we have probably at this point, we've been doing the show for 6 years, we probably paid some attention to it by now. We also have a Facebook group. Just search Facebook for School Sucks Project. You'll find us. There's a lot of lively discussion that goes on there. We have a YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show.
Awesome. Daryl?
I'm over at voluntaryvisions.com. It's right now just using as a depository. I've got other work and that I'm working on, but that's where all of the pretty much my portfolio of audio and written work is.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right. We're in the books.
In the books. In the can.
In the can.
Yeah. That was fun.
You guys have fun?
I can't believe I had so many notes. I've got a whole other show I've got to do now because I have so many notes I didn't get to.
I know. I have two sets of notes that I didn't get to. So.
Well, what I did was... I went through like my Evernote and I just made a composite of like, based on what you said you wanted to talk about, like a composite of like four different older notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I added some new stuff to it. But most of it we didn't even cover. But it was still great.
Right.
We didn't need my notes to make a great show.
You should have shared your notes ahead of time.
I'm going to say, I'm going to love to see your notes, Brett. I'm the one who showed up here with no notes.
And so, you killed it.
And you killed it, yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.